Overboard, Jonah, a familiar story to most of us. Matter of fact, people who don't even connect with God in much of any way would understand and know Jonah's story, at least the basics of it. I mean, how can you ignore it? Four brief chapters, but yet in four brief chapters, it packs a punch that knocks us all to our feet, from our feet, knocks the wind out of our sails. It teaches us God's ways. And sometimes God's ways are not pleasant to experience. Sometimes it takes a Jonah story, or pulling a Jonah, if you will, to get the point across. So we're looking over just a few weeks. Four chapters, 4 weeks is all we're going to spend in Jonah. That's really all we need. That's enough to set the course for the foreseeable future. And we're talking through a brief outline, chapter by chapter. Chapter one was Jonah runs from God. Chapter two that we look at today is Jonah runs to God. Chapter three is going to be Jonah runs with God. And then chapter four is going to be Jonah runs ahead of God. And each one of those little prepositional phrases, if you will, describing the action of Jonah, portray the decisions and the choices that we make in life. But we've made it to the main part of the book, at least in the minds of some, what I would call the famous fish. But really, folks, the fish is not that big a deal. We focus way too much on Jonah and the whale, or Jonah and the sea monster, the sea creature, the big fish. Whereas the big fish is just mentioned one time here. It's just a brief time. It undergirds the message, but let's look at things from the bigger picture. The fish isn't that big a deal when it's compared to God's will being worked out in Jonah's life. But what about that fish? It says in Jonah chapter 1, verse 17, as we spill into the verses of chapter 2, that the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah was in the stomach of the fish 3 days and three nights. Now, you remember what brought us up to this point. Last week, Jonah received an assignment from God. Go to Nineveh. Nineveh was directly, if you're looking this way at a map of the world at that time, Jonah's here, Nineveh's over here, but Jonah decides to do the very opposite. So he goes down to Joppa on the Mediterranean coast and gets on a ship and is heading what would appear to most of us to be a place called Tarshish, which is in southwestern Spain, which is just far away as you could get from where he needed to be. God brought about a tremendous storm on the Mediterranean. And when all was said and done, Jonah finally convinced the men that he was responsible for their calamity. And if they would just toss him overboard, that things would calm down. And that's exactly what they did. They threw the man overboard. They threw God's prophet overboard. And chapter 1, verse 17 says, God provided a big fish that swallowed Jonah. Okay, time out. Some people look at this and they just start laughing at anyone who would take these events as being literally true. So you'd have to say, is this fact or is it fiction? I have read countless commentaries where people have tried to do what they called research to prove that this big fish actually swallowed a man. There are whaling legends all the way through history. Most of them, my friends, are totally without merit. They are false. They are National Enquirer type reports. Even the ones that could be so-called documented turned out to be false. That a certain man in the 18th century, 19th century, who was supposedly on such and such a ship, when you got the passenger manifest, his name was not on that record. And everyone totally debunked whatever it was that he said. So you can talk about whaling legends. You can talk about whether this is true or not. Matter of fact, some of the best sermons I have ever read by preachers from centuries past totally denied the literalness of this story. They saw it as simply a parable, a story that had a symbolic meaning. There are going to be people that look at it that way. I'm not going to stop you. I'm not going to condemn you if you say there's no way this literally could happen. I personally take it at face value. I have no problem with God creating a fish big enough to take on the body of a man and to keep him alive for 3 days. Doesn't bother me in the least because I take it at face value. Keep in mind, when you say Jonah and the whale, you've mispronounced the Hebrew word. You've used the wrong word. It's not a word for whale. It's a word for big fish. Could have been anything. But there is one person who evidently took this as being historical truth. It's found in Matthew chapter 12, verses 39 and 40. It's where Jesus is talking to the Pharisees, those who were trying to entrap him, those who were trying to trip him up, those who were spiteful toward him, those who hated him. They're eventually going to get him nailed to a cross, but this is early on. And when they stop Jesus, ask him for a sign, prove yourself. You say all these things. We heard rumor of some of the miracles and the healings that you've been responsible for, but give us a sign. Give us something that will tell us that you're the real deal. And this is what Jesus said. He said, he answered them, "An evil and adulterous generation craves for a sign, yet no sign will be given to it but the sign of Jonah the prophet. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the sea monster, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth." Now Jesus is taking what would appear to be something that he took at face value, something that, as he states it, actually happened, and he is taking it and making a pictorial representation, a symbolic meaning. Just as Jonah was in the belly of a big fish for 3 days and three nights, so will the Son of Man be. Son of Man, that's Jesus' title for himself. No one calls him Son of Man. Jesus calls himself Son of Man. A term that was loaded with meaning in the first century, no doubt. When they heard Son of Man, they hearkened back to prophecy, some in the Old Testament, some outside of the Bible itself. But when one talked about Son of Man, they were talking about that divine representative of God who would come and bring everything to its proper close, that would turn the curtain, turn the page, close the curtain on history. And Jesus says the Son of Man will be in the tomb 3 days and three nights, just as Jonah was in the belly of the big fish 3 days and three nights. So it appears that Jesus had no problem with this being a literal event. You'll do with it what you want. If you deny the miraculous, I can't stop you from doing that. But then again, if you believe in a God who created all things out of nothing, if you believe in a God who has our best interests in mind, it really wouldn't take too much on his part to take a disobedient prophet that when God said, "Go here," Jonah did an about face and went the opposite way. It wouldn't take too much for a God who created that prophet, who gave him that mandate, to arrange for these circumstances to be one that not only would Jonah learn a life lesson, but we would have the opportunity to learn it as well. So in my way of thinking, God provided a big fish, some type of sea creature, that didn't swallow Jonah whole, but put him right there in the opening of his mouth, if you will, where he could survive. And then what happened? Well, Jonah prayed, it says. Now, I look at that and go, very smart thing to do, Jonah. He prayed. First thing that came to his brain was to cry out to God. Let's read the prayer. Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish, and he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol. You heard my voice. For you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas. The current engulfed me. All your breakers and billows passed over me. So I said, I've been expelled from your sight. Nevertheless, I will look again towards your holy temple. Water encompassed me to the point of death. The great deep engulfed me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I descended to the roots of the mountains. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. While I was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you and to your holy temple. Those who regard vain idols forsake their faithfulness. But I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. That which I have vowed, I will pay. Salvation is from the Lord. All right, let's look at this prayer a little closer. I don't think that Jonah was writing out this prayer so that it could be kept somewhere along the way and telling the story, because this story is told, this event is told in the third person. It's not Jonah, first person, telling us, this is what happened to me. Someone is relaying these things that happened to the prophet. But somehow, some way, in putting together everything that happened, the basics of his prayer are preserved here. And we see some amazing things. He called out in distress. Obviously. He said, I cried for help from the depth of Sheol, S-H-E-O-L. Where in the world is that place? What does that word mean? Here's a little insight about people who lived during the Old Testament times. We celebrate, memorialize, have funeral services, and what do? When we go out to a graveside, we don't bury people, we plant them. Remember that. Because we have a hope for growth, for resurrection, for new life. We have this full-blown doctrine of the resurrection of the dead because Jesus was the only one, is the only one who has ever been resurrected to a resurrection body. We have all this information, all this teaching to draw from. We can smile at the future because we have the hope of the resurrection. Not so in the Old Testament. You will not find the people, the men and the women of the Old Testament, especially those who were closest to God, the prophets, with any certainty about the future dealing with the resurrection. They hadn't heard of the word. It hadn't happened. So Sheol, in their mind and in their culture, was an abode of the dead, a shadowy place, something that could be construed as being in the depths of the sea, perhaps. So keep in mind, these people who lived in Israel, they weren't seaworthy. They didn't love the idea of hopping on a ship and sailing all the way across the Mediterranean. They got out just as far as they could get to fish. But other than that, they loved the dry sands of the desert. They loved the Dead Sea Valley where Masada was, where they could plant their feet on solid ground. But Jonah says, I was wandering through the abode of the dead. And if anything brought a smile to his face, it was the fact that he realized he wasn't alone. That God was with him. Important point. We think of God being with us when we obey, but when we disobey, he what? Casts his presence away from us, kicks us out. God's with him in his obedience. God is with him in his disobedience. And whatever that idea was of what do I do with a faithful life, he had to leave in the hands of God. Now, so do we. But we got the big picture drawn for us. We have all the conclusions already written out for us. We know the hope of the resurrection. These people trusted in a God. And that was about all they knew to do. A cryptic saying every now and then, like Job, who would say, I know that my Redeemer lives and one day upon this earth again shall stand. That's about as close as they could get to God will resurrect me. So Jonah, in the jaws of a sea creature, as he is crying out and praying to God and then remembering it later, remembers that he had been cast into the belly or through the jaws of this fish because of his disobedience, but God was right there with him. He says, I've been expelled from your sight, but I will look again toward your holy temple, wherever God is. Water encompassed me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. But who has the power to save? He says, God and God alone. So in this prayer of desperation, in this prayer of faithfulness, as we look back upon it, we got to see it from his perspective, not ours. He calls upon God. And God saves Jonah. Chapter 2, verse 10. Then the Lord commanded the fish, and it vomited Jonah up onto the dry land. Interesting. Most likely, the big fish cruised those 3 days back to the shoreline of Israel. Doesn't say it specifically, but it's assumed that when the big fish spat Jonah out of his mouth, he landed probably near Joppa, where he had caught that ship in the first place. Some who look really at this carefully, literally, will say that Jonah probably was albino white because of the stomach acids of any fish. If you endured that long and survived, which Jonah did, that it would have changed the pigment of your hair and your skin. You imagine what people thought when they saw him looking different, looking rather fishy. Folks, these four little chapters pack a punch. God saves us for a purpose. Don't you ever forget that. When Jonah was delivered from the jaws of this sea creature, big fish, whale, whatever you want to call it, he was spared so that he could what? So that he could obey. God didn't save him just to say, be on your way, my friend. God gave him a second chance. God did what he did because God had a purpose for Jonah's life, for his vocation, for his actions, for his words. And God wasn't going to let go of Jonah. He saves him for a purpose, which happens to be the very same purpose he had brought to him in chapter 1. I want you to go to Nineveh and prophesy. You notice if you look through this, almost everyone and everything obeys. I mean, it's a perfect setup. The wind and the sea, they obey. God is empowered here. God directs the wind and the sea. The sailors, as pagan as they were, the sailors obey. They toss Jonah overboard. The big fish obeys. He's there, brought to that place for that specific purpose. And he does so, and by the power of the God who created all things, did so without taking the life of Jonah, allowing him to experience a unique environment for the better part of 3 days and three nights. The big fish obeyed. But as we get to the next couple of chapters, in the next couple of weeks, we're going to find that a pagan king, the king of Nineveh, obeys. And to top that off, the citizens of Nineveh, they obey. In chapter 3, verse 4, there's a prophecy. And as best I can tell, it is the one prophecy made in the Old Testament that never comes true. Before you get up and say, wait a minute, whatever God says happens, understand that. But it says in chapter 3, verse 4, when Jonah did obey and make his way to Nineveh, Jonah began to go through the city one day's walk, and he cried out and he said, yet 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. Never happened. The one prophecy you will find in the Old Testament where the prophet of God stands up and boldly declares God's will. It never happens. Why? Because the people of Nineveh turned to God. Because the people of Nineveh heard the revival message of Jonah, which was a double-edged sword, remember? An opportunity to receive grace, but also coming with it. If you don't respond with obedience, it will be judgment. And here we have, lo and behold, of all the prophecies in the Old Testament, here's the one that never happens. And Jonah is mad because it didn't happen. Did you hear me? Jonah is hacked off at God because Jonah made a prophecy from God, and that prophecy never came true. Friends, John 3:16, for God so loved. For God so loved countries where white people live. For God so loved those who can bring economic prosperity with them when they enter our country. Is that what John 3:16 says? No. It says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. Jonah was mad at God because God's love encompassed the entire world. And I think there's a lot of people. Jonah isn't the name inscribed on the birth certificate of some of us, but it just as well might be, should be, is. I do not care about your political persuasion. I'm not concerned with who you vote for or who you don't vote for. But God so loved the world that he sent Jesus. And thousands of years ago, a man never really understood the depth of God's love, even though he had been in the depths of the sea, imprisoned in the jaws of a big fish. We had a funeral here yesterday. About 1,200 people showed up for it. It was our Chin friends. Our Chin friends who came to this country and followed the rules and are here legally. Our Chin friends who are seeking to make a life for themselves and their families. And they're doing a very good job of it. As our country, in a sense, is doing a very good job of helping them thrive and flourish. But it's not that way for everybody. I made a mistake. I misspoke. I said that this is the one prophecy in the Old Testament that never came true. That is true. Except Nineveh was destroyed. It was hundreds of years later. But they did go down. And Israel, the north kingdom, was destroyed. And Judah, the south kingdom of Israel, was destroyed. Historically documented in 586 BC. The north kingdom, historically documented in 722 BC. The fall of Nineveh wiped that culture off the face of the earth. The fall of the north in 722 BC wiped the north kingdom and the 10 tribes out of 12 from the face of the earth, never to be heard from again, except when you read about Samaritans and the racial tension that's between Jew and Samaritan even to this day. So what's the point of it all? God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son. Our mission, our commission, our marching orders have not changed, my friends. Governments come and go, countries come and go, cultures come and go. But until God closes the curtain on history, any and all who claim to follow Jesus will be given this same mandate time and time again. We send missionaries to the far corners of the earth because we believe in that commission. And we do well to watch our attitudes, to watch our language, and to realize if we need to call ourselves Jonah, that we do so. Who's missing? Who's missing from all these who obeyed? Well, I can think of two. Jonah and yours truly. Can't speak for anybody else. And my desire is to obey. Father, thank you for this day. Thank you for the opportunity to gather here, to call upon your name, knowing that you hear us when we pray, knowing that you care about us, knowing that you're with us when we obey, and you're with us even when we disobey. Help us to stand for what is right, to be loving to all who come our way. It's in the name of Christ we offer our prayer. Amen. We offer an invitation as we wrap up this hour. This is the way we conclude every service. It could be that there are those here who have yet to say yes to the claim of Jesus upon your life. We mentioned him a little bit today. Our focus wasn't on what he did for us upon the cross, though it undergirds everything. But the only way to find salvation, the only way to get your steps in line with God's will is through his Son, Jesus. So if that's the desire of your heart, to give your life to him, to find out more about what he's all about and what he demands of us, what he asks of us, then I want you to come forward. There'll be ministers and deacons standing here to receive you, to pray for you. Maybe you know the Lord, just hadn't told anyone. Tell us. Maybe you never followed him in believer's baptism. Let's talk about it. It's his desire. It's his command for us to do that. Maybe you need a church to call your own. Are we a perfect church? Absolutely not. But we are a family of faith seeking to bring God's kingdom closer to this earth. And we wait for the return of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. We have the hope of the resurrection. We've got all those tools available to us. And yet, so many of us just stumble across the truth. We never connect. Well, it happens through church. So how do you join a church like ours? You come forward. That's the first step. And then you find a place to serve, to belong. And then once again, for most of us, is your middle name Jonah? I find myself that argument time and time again, each and every day. I have my own ideas. I have my own plans. And then I find myself crying out to God, not from the belly of a fish, but from my own despair. And God is with me. And He gives us a second and a third chance. What does that mean for your life? I don't know. Maybe it just start by how you think and how you act. Maybe it'll calm the rhetoric among us. I don't know. Let God have His way in your life. That's our invitation. I ask you to stand with us as we wait for you here. Won't you step out as God leads?